Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's July 25, 2016, and this is episode 533. This week, I share an awesome conversation with my friend Don Komarechka about his most recent crazy scientist photography, as he sinks his teeth into full spectrum, infrared and ultraviolet photography, as well as stereoscopic 3D macro photography. As Don himself said when he emailed me about this work, it makes for a fun outside-the-box chat, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. To view the full-sized images that we'll talk about today, go to the blog at mbp.ac/533 and open your browser window up nice and wide, and then just click on the images to view them. Also, just roll your mouse over the images to stop them from auto-advancing. If you don't have your mouse over them, then every 6 seconds you'll move to the next photograph. But to stop that, just put your mouse over there. Okay, so let's jump into my conversation with Don Komarechka. Okay, so welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast once again, Don. So everyone will know you, but welcome back.
Thank you so much, Martin. I think I've been on a number of times, but it's been a while. So, yeah. We've talked about some crazy stuff in the past, and we're going to push those limits further today, I think.
I'm not sure. I should have checked before we started to record, but Don Komarechka, you've been, I think we talked about your Snowflakes book, and that was an excellent conversation. So long-time listeners will recall a couple of conversations. So it's an old friend here back on the show, and we've got like two or three topics that we want to talk about, and we're just going to have fun, and I think that the audience are going to enjoy this. So tell us, you know, just for those that might not have heard about it, tell us a little bit about yourself, Don. You know, what sort of photography you do and all
that.
The
photography that, if I could sum up the stuff that interests me the most, is the unseen world. It is the stuff that I can't see with my own eyes, that a camera can allow me to explore. And so early on in my career, I discovered my passion in photography was those moments that the camera became a tool to see things differently, to find a different perspective on everything that I would normally be seeing. And I've embraced that, and I continue to push limits into all manner of infrared photography, ultraviolet, heck, even 3D photography, which, you know, is something as old as photography itself, and it's fallen away, but it's, you know, with 3D viewers and VR headsets and everything, it's bound to make a comeback, and I'm trying to make that happen.
Well, you've just blown my mind moments before we started recording by showing me one of your images and having me go cross-eyed and look at it on the screen. And I was amazed that, you know, without even any apparatus, I could see all of the beautiful 3D details of a photograph that we'll look at later. So I think that you're already off to a good start. And you know, people that know Don, you'll already know he's not only a talented artist, but a very technical, geeky guy. And I mean that in the most, it's a term of endearment.
I have a propeller hat. But I can spin the little, yeah.
So
good thing we're not recording video here, Martin.
Yeah.
Or are we?
I'm not. But
okay, good.
So now the thing is that, you know, Don, as he just explained about himself, he tends to sort of get into a certain area of photography, and then he becomes, within a relatively short amount of time, he becomes one of the experts in that field. And that's one of the reasons why I really enjoy talking with Don, because, you know, your Snowflake work, I don't think I can mention anyone on the planet, anyone else that does Snowflake work anywhere near as well as you do. And so, you know, these new lines that you're expanding into, I've seen some of your infrared work as well, but we're going to talk about stuff today that I'd not really caught up on. And I'm sure that you're going to knock it out of the park, because that's what you normally do with these things. So first of all, let's talk a little bit about, you say that you're getting a deeper understanding of full spectrum infrared and ultraviolet photography. So let's start talking about this a little bit more.
All right. So it's interesting because if we go back to the way a camera is designed, it uses a sensor that is, you know, made of silicon, and it's sensitive to light in a different way than our eyes are, to a broader spectrum than our eyes are capable of seeing. So human vision typically starts at around 400 nanometers, which is violet, and then ends at around 700 nanometers, which is like a deep red. And that that range of light encompasses everything that we can see. But a camera in its native form can see beyond that. It can see into the ultraviolet and into the infrared. But if it captures that information, it's not very helpful because the image is going to turn out looking very strange because there's on a sunny day, there's almost as much infrared light as there is visible light. And so that's going to screw up everything that you see. The images are going to turn out really strange. So there's a filter that gets placed in front of the camera sensor that specifically is there to block ultraviolet and infrared so that the camera is only receiving the visible spectrum and the images look like the world that we see. So, and that's all well and good. In most cases, that's what you want your camera to do.
Yeah.
But if you want to explore beyond that, and there's some fun stuff that happens beyond the world that we see, then you can get that filter removed.
Yeah. I've heard of people do that. Yeah.
And so you can take another filter and put it in its place that says lets only a certain amount of infrared light through, or you can put just a clear protective glass in that lets all light in. And then you can control that by putting filters in front of your lens that would filter the wavelengths and let you play around with different things. So it's a really fun area to explore when you start to take this camera that's sensitive to light that you can't see with your own eyes. And it's like you're walking through a parallel universe because everything's there. Everything's in the same place, but it all looks different. You know, nothing is really quite the same as you'd normally understand it to be.
Yeah, I've seen this sort of photography before. I think it's incredibly fascinating. I've never done it myself. I've never actually... my problem with this stuff is for me to get a camera converted, I would have to use an older camera. And I'm such a, I don't know, I'm so binary. Once I get a new camera, the old camera, I mean, normally I just part exchange it anyway. But generally the resolution is lower. So for me to be able to do something like this, I would have to buy another 5DSR and have it a brand new camera converted. So I've never got into it, but that's just...
But you can always buy a pre-converted camera too. There's places that will sell them brand new out of the box, and you don't have to buy a camera and then ship it to them and then and have it come back. You just, you know, pay for it with the conversion already in place. Or, you know, like I just bought a Canon Digital Rebel, the KISS Digital in Japan, the very first Digital Rebel for $30. On eBay because I'm doing an article about sort of like it's not about the gear. The photographer is more valuable than the equipment. And so I intentionally went to buy a, like by today's standards, a terrible digital SLR in order to try and make some good images with it. And I'm sure that, you know, I'll be able to get something useful to prove a point. But the point of mentioning it is that it doesn't cost a whole lot if you're willing to sacrifice on the utmost clarity and quality in order to experiment.
Well, that was my point.
You've got to keep experimenting.
That's for me why I haven't done it, because if I'm going to be making photographs, I want them to be the same resolution. I want them to be 50 megapixels now. So that's my point, because that's just me. I think that I really respect the fact that you're doing this. And what I want to do is I'm going to actually, let's take a look at one of the photos that can explain this a little bit more so that the audience can relate to what we're talking about. So,
absolutely.
The first one that you sent me, that's an infrared, you said.
Well, let's talk about 4307, which is it's a wonderful infrared daylight scene.
Yeah.
And this image is taken with a fisheye lens.
Yeah.
So it's got a 180-degree field of view, which I like, again, unique perspectives on things.
Yeah.
But what's interesting here is that all of the foliage on anything that produces photosynthesis, regardless of what color it is, like a purple maple tree or a green one, all of their leaves reflect almost all infrared light. So that makes them glow in infrared. And it's really fun to see this because now these trees are just like so vibrant, almost like they're covered with snow or frost.
It looks like a winter scene with hoarfrost all over the. But just to clarify, these are green leaves, right? It's a green scene, right?
It is a green scene. But it is not that green just turns white. Mm. Right. This has nothing to do with the visible spectrum.
Yeah. Yeah.
The light collected in the visible spectrum is not being used in this image at all. Mm. So it does kind of play by a different rule book. The skies in infrared light are often very, very dark. Mm. As you could imagine, the normal color of the sky that we see blue is in the exact opposite end to red and infrared thereby. So the skies end up being quite dark. Mm. And that creates these really high contrast outlines along those trees. And it defines shapes and lines in an image with a level of almost magical contrast that you just can't get any other way.
Mm. Yeah. You know, my visual senses, the moment I looked at this, thinking, oh, look at that beautiful hoarfrost scene. It doesn't even look to me like an infrared photo. But then, you know, the fact that you can shoot this in, I don't know, in a totally different season, it's opening up creative streams for you that wouldn't really be there unless you were doing this infrared stuff.
Yeah, and to push that farther, you know, infrared photography, especially because the sky gets so dark, clouds, if you have clouds in the sky, they reflect a lot of infrared light because on a cloudy day, it's less hot, right? They're all being reflected away.
Yeah.
So those clouds, you have far higher contrast in any skyline with clouds in it than you would ever have in visible light. If you've got like a very hazy, not necessarily distorted, but very low contrast horizon line, and there are some clouds, but you can't make out much detail, if that same image is done in infrared, it just pops at you. That would be like image 9817 in that list, and there's sort of like old barn structures and grass and the skies are just like magnetic almost. I don't know if that word even applies, but there's just something beyond what you could normally perceive. Yeah. And you might be able to get there by editing a regular picture to get a similar effect.
Yeah.
You could probably push it, but in infrared, it's there. It's staring you in the face.
Right.
And it's fun because sometimes I'll take this infrared camera around with me because you use live view on it because otherwise you can't really see where the compositions are going to be because the lines are going to be different. The ones that jump out at you aren't the same as that you see visually.
That's interesting.
So I use live view to compose, but I'm like walking around with live view in front of me, like a total dork, just looking at the world like this is my window to that parallel universe. Mm. But there's also, there's two really important reasons why you would need to use live view. One of them is that infrared light will focus at a different point than visible light does. And on some lenses, the Canon L series lenses will typically have like a little red dot on the focusing window.
Yeah.
Or if it's a zoom lens, you'll have a few little red lines on them. Mm. Those are infrared offset markers that will tell you how far to shift the focus on the lens. But if you're using live view, you don't have to do that. You can just use the LCD screen to get your focus properly. Yeah. And the exposure meter in the camera, that's normally viewable when the viewfinder is active, like it's collecting its own light to figure out the exposure at the same time. It's working with the visible light numbers. And in daylight, they might be about equal, but not in every scenario. So if you want a proper exposure and proper focus and proper composition, then live view ends up being one of those things to help you quite a bit. It takes a lot of the frustration away.
That's really interesting. I'd never really considered that. I use live view a lot in my regular photography, but it wouldn't for me be that big a change, but I'd not really considered that. So I'm sure that's going to be very helpful for anyone that wants to get into this sort of photography. But the barn shot, it's beautiful. It's amazing how the wood and the foreground is just such a different color.
I'm glad you mentioned color because the color in these infrared images are fake.
Oh, okay.
These colors don't exist.
They don't.
Right?
Okay. Sure. So what are you doing there?
So these wavelengths of light, they do have color that, like, if you were to say take a 720 nanometer wavelength of light, it has a number that can be associated to it, but no color that can be associated to it. So if you sway your white balance around, you can remap those colors back into the visible spectrum. Now, if you do that, typically, right out of camera, your sky will be sort of a muddy orange-brown, and foreground elements, depending on the kind of conversion you get, might be white or might have a bluish or cyan color to them. And that looks kind of weird. It looks a little bit too far from reality. So what a lot of people do, and I do this a lot with my color infrared work, is you channel swap. Very easy to do in Photoshop. I think there's even some plugins for Lightroom to do this. You swap the red and the blue color channels around. When you do that and then shift the colors back into place a little bit, you can make the sky blue again. And so I try to get that blue sky effect in a lot of these images only because that makes it look a little bit closer to our reality. And that kind of bridges into that surrealism realm where it, is this reality? Is it not? Well, it's harder to tell the difference, and thereby it becomes a bit more interesting because of it. And the foreground color, well, in that particular image, I painted it in. It was kind of a bit of a yellowish, reddish kind of color, but I figured purple looked nicer. I just wanted that color contrast to play, and so that was just manual color painting in post. The colors in any infrared image are always going to be fake by whatever means the photographer deems necessary, and I could have made the sky green or purple or whatever it was. So it is the choice of the artist because those colors just don't exist.
I didn't realize that. That's so cool. So, are any of the others examples of this as well?
The funnest self-portrait I've ever done is 9563. And I was setting up to do a night photo shoot in one of our provincial parks here. And, you get to the location beforehand, you just got time to waste, right? And so I'm just digging through my camera bag and playing around with all sorts of different things. And I had a very unique filter in there for use in ultraviolet photography, of all things. It blocks infrared light by reflecting it. It's called a hot mirror filter. And there's very little use for any photographer to ever own this kind of filter. They're not that expensive, but they are rather obscure. So I had this for a completely different purpose, but I figured, well, if that's what it's doing, if it's reflecting infrared, well, what happens if I hold it up in front of my camera? And I realized it's a mirror.
So I
happen to have been doing a couple of tests with the at the time it was the new Canon 8 to 15 fisheye, and so this is a circular fisheye lens image done in infrared with a hot mirror filter being held up as a reflection of me behind the camera, which. And in this case, I chose to do the channel swapping for the background and everything else, but to leave the regular colors as they would be out of the camera in the filter to give it that little shift there.
Yeah, so that's brilliant. It's very unique. I've seen this online as well, but it's great. I mean, your eyes look crazy. It's almost like a Dracula moment there. But that's...
Yeah, well, your skin tone becomes completely smooth. If you have any blemishes, they disappear. So you look like you're eternally young, and your eyes get very dark. So it is like a vampire filter almost.
Yeah. Oh, it's brilliant. And I love the fact that even in this mirror, you can see some of the landscape in there as well, reflected in your camera.
The mirror that I was using is not a perfect infrared mirror. It was letting some of it still pass through it. And to me, in this effect, it worked perfectly because it just keeps the depth there.
Yeah. Oh, it's brilliant. I love that. So there's one other that might not be related. I was looking down. Let's give you a number. So is 873, is that this as well or is that something else?
873 is a really fun experiment that has nothing to do with infrared, but we can go there because this is a fun thing to talk about. I was doing some experiments with using invisible ink. And invisible ink is something that, again, in extra spectrum photography, I've been gathering bits and pieces of interesting things. Like I've got flashlights that emit ultraviolet light. I've modified camera flashes to only emit ultraviolet light as well. And so in this case, I realized when I was trying to do some of my night photography and some of my things in the dark, with this flashlight around, you're shining it on different things and they fluoresce. Like just standard white paper will fluoresce like crazy because it has something called optical brightening agents in it. And it's funny because... Martin and I were just recording a podcast for my show, and we didn't even mention optical brightening agents when we were talking about printing. How did we miss that? Anyhow, a lot of things will glow like crazy in ultraviolet.
I've got one here as well. I have one similar to that, but I've got this tiny little pocket ultraviolet light, and I use it for shining on paper just to show people whether it's got OBAs in it or not.
Yeah, well, so I got this big one here, and I can shine it on this this clear fluid that then becomes a glowing fluid, right? So this is a pen filled with invisible ink designed for fountain pens. You can buy the stuff by the bottle. And so these experiments were trying to use invisible ink as a light source. Because if the image is illuminated only with ultraviolet light, that means that the camera can't see ultraviolet light. Your regular camera cannot detect it. But when that light interacts with the ink, it fluoresces, it gives off light, and it appears that that light is then glowing from within that that object. So this image is a Gerbera daisy, and I've placed with a hypodermic needle a droplet of invisible ink right in the center of that. And there are other droplets that were sprayed around from a spray bottle.
Oh, wow. So yeah. I mean, it almost looks like astrophotography, like a night sky, but yeah, you know, they look like stars everywhere. Right. I mean, what was it Men in Black where they had the ring or something with this tiny galaxy in there?
It reminded me exactly like that. The title for the image is A Universe Born.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's and beautiful. So when I kind of discovered that quite by accident, because I was trying to shoot another image where I was spraying a dandelion seed with invisible ink, and that is a dumb thing to do inside, because I couldn't see it until I shined the ultraviolet flashlight around it and everything, and it looked like blood splatter or something from those CSI movies where they shine the ultraviolet light to see where somebody was murdered. That was my studio, and I'm like, okay, that's how would I explain this to people? My accountants are questioning me enough when I have invisible ink and hypodermic needles on my tax return as expenses.
Yeah. I mean, my accountant does the same thing. I mean, I buy all sorts of things that I'm using for my photography, and it could look a little bit, what's the word? The word that comes to mind is dubious, but that's not. we certainly end up getting, and I'm sure you more than me. Stuff.
I expensed a heated dog bowl on my last taxes. I don't own a dog, by the way, but I needed some device that, when left outside, would keep water from freezing, but keep it very, very close to the freezing temperature so that it would evaporate and then freeze in crystal form onto other stuff. I was trying to grow frost.
Making a hoarfrost machine.
And so a heated dog bowl is the piece of equipment required to do that.
Brilliant. I love the fact that you do all of this, such crazy experimentation.
The thing is, when I do these experiments, I push into areas of photography that sometimes people have not gone before, or very seldomly have they gone. Some of the areas that I've explored, I've seen images taken by like a scientist with a camera to prove something, but not actually a well done photograph with all of the photographic intent and creativity that I could put into it. So I see those images that are badly done from like 10 years ago when somebody was trying to write a paper on something, and I figured, wow, I need to explore that and see how much further I can push it. And so the other day I was approached by some people working on a documentary for Discovery Channel. And they asked me if I would, and this is something that might be coming up towards the end of the year, if I could sit in with one of their film crews to do some stills of mosquitoes alongside them filming them in a nearby research facility. And I said, yeah, for sure. So I immediately got an interest in mosquitoes. And so then I was looking around and I found a dead one in our sunroom here. And I figured, okay, well, what if I take that and what if I place that in front of my ultraviolet only flashes? Mm. And what if I take that mosquito and try to illuminate it with ultraviolet light? And wouldn't you know it, it glows.
So this is the photo called Mosquito, right?
Yeah.
I'll embed this in the podcast as well. So
because
that's beautiful.
You know, you can tell this one's dead because the eyes are kind of caved in a little bit. But this is actually a 98 image focus stack. On a macro scale to get everything nice and sharp front to back on that guy. And I had no idea. Now this thing, it has two flashes at point blank range, like right on top of it.
Yeah.
At full power, and then the camera is still at some crazy ISO, ISO 4000, because there's not a lot that gets reflected. But with today's camera equipment, you can get in there and you can do some pretty magical stuff. Wow. And so I was outside cleaning or taking some of the laundry that we had hung out to dry, and there was a giant cicada that was just hanging off of one of the sheets that we put out there. So I brought him into my studio. They're relatively docile creatures. They'll sit in one place like a walking stick or a praying mantis for a little while, and you can kind of place them.
A walking stick?
Have you ever seen a walking stick insect?
No, I've never. No. I thought you were just making a joke. Is there an insect a walking stick insect?
There is an insect called a walking stick. type that into Google if you get a chance. They are really bizarre creatures as well. They're quite huge, actually.
Wow.
They're designed to mimic a stick, and thereby they'll stay perfectly posed in a stick position as a defense mechanism.
Wow.
But so cicadas, they're relatively docile. And so I set it on a filter that is designed for infrared photography. It's a very deep filter. It's a 900 nanometer filter. By the nature of how they created it, it also reflects light, visible light anyhow. And I figured, well, it would probably reflect ultraviolet light if that's the case. And so I set this cicada down on that, and in the visible spectrum that guy is interesting. This image won't win any awards and it won't keep my interest for very long. It's more documentary than anything. But then when I beam in those ultraviolet lights on this guy, I had no clue that its wings would glow brightly, looking like, I don't know, some sci-fi architecture mixed with Cinderella's dress. I'm not sure. But it becomes magical.
This, again, it's just incredibly beautiful. Like you say, the wings are glowing. The eyes as well. The fact that the eyes just seem to be popping out there.
And then once those images of that cicada were made, out it goes outside to parts unknown. It's funny though, because I worry that I might cross a line for some of this stuff. And so it's hard to decide where the line is until you've crossed it. And I didn't send you this other image because I don't really want to be sharing it too much, because I think I did cross the line with it. But I had seen a kid science experiment before, and it's where you feed ants, ghost ants or ants with a relatively transparent gaster, that's their butt, you feed them multicolored, like food colored water, sugar water, and they eat it up, and then their butt turns red or blue or green or whatever food coloring you had given it to. So I thought, well, what happens if I feed an ant invisible ink? And then take pictures of it with these ultraviolet flashes. And it was cool. But then I got to thinking, you know, if I'm doing this for science, then I think that that's acceptable. If I'm feeding foreign liquids to insects for my art, I think that crosses the line.
Well, is it toxic? Do you know? I mean,
You know, I tried to do a test. I put a few ants in a container, one being fed sugar water and another one, or two ants in each. The other container contained the invisible ink sugar water. And in 24 hours, one ant in each jar was dead. The other one was alive. So inconclusive. I don't know. It doesn't look like they would hurt them. And yeah. To be honest, scientists will use tracers, which are usually color agents in insects and animals that they're trying to research the generations and sort of the family tree of how they interact. Some of those tracers are UV fluorescent, and these insects survive their lives perfectly fine with those in there. So I did try to give to feed flowers invisible ink as well. Which is interesting because if you go to the supermarket or the flower store, particularly around Mother's Day or Valentine's Day, they'll have these rainbow roses where they've cut the stem of the rose into four quadrants. And then they feed each quadrant a different color dye, and it makes all the petals at the top of the flower into a rainbow color. So I figured, well, what if I feed a flower invisible ink? Will it glow? And yes, it does. And then quickly dies because the invisible ink is not compatible with whatever structures are in there. So as soon as it starts to spread out, then the flower doesn't function anymore.
You're like a mad scientist. This kills me.
But they're easy experiments to do. You just have to kind of think outside the box. And so they become engineering challenges before they become photographic ones. But that's part of the fun for me. Yeah. So long as the result is enjoyable as some otherworldly experience in photography. And I think that I'm able to hit the mark sometimes.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of near misses where it's like, that's cool, but that really doesn't work. Like there's one image in here that I've got to do more experimenting with, and I've got all the gear now to do it. It's 9933. It's an ultraviolet image of a dandelion. And what's interesting is a lot of flowers have patterns in them that you can't see with your own eyes because those patterns are only visible in ultraviolet light. Insects can see them because many insects can see ultraviolet. So dandelions, which are a solid yellow flower, in ultraviolet, they have a dark center, almost like a bullseye to guide insects in, or I'm not sure exactly how it works, but it appears differently. And so that was sort of a proof of concept image. And so now I've got, I converted a Canon 1DX to full spectrum photography, and I've got the proper filters to put in front of it to do ultraviolet work to a greater degree. And I was walking around again with my camera, pointing at all of the flowers. Lilies have very, very dark centers. And there's some other flowers that have completely hidden patterns, some lines in them that don't, that we can't see at all. So, brilliant. Yeah, it's an adventure. It really is an adventure.
Absolutely.
And an experience too, because it's not only just creating these, it's sitting back and saying, okay, what is this? How have I, you know, what am I doing to figure this out? And then how can I kind of enhance that? How can I see things differently?
Before we move on, if this is another one that's in the same category, can we talk a little bit about 0276? This is the first one I think that I did a huge exclamation. This just blows my mind. I love this photograph.
I'm not seeing it in my list because I might not have gotten them all here. Describe it quickly.
It's the one that's like the frozen sphere of...
Yes. Okay. So this was my my concept of me trying to reinvent something that I had already done pretty well. I have done a lot of photography of freezing soap bubbles. In fact, some of that footage has just recently been featured in a BBC documentary episode of The Forces of Nature. That footage is in the title card of that documentary. I am honored and thrilled for that. And a lot of the footage gets used throughout. But during those experiments, I wanted to push things further. So I figured, well, what happens if I can make a freezing soap bubble fluoresce under ultraviolet light?
Yeah, as you do. I mean, that crosses my mind most Sunday afternoon.
I tried a number of different things. It's just out of reach here, but I bought a pigment, some powder that will fluoresce under ultraviolet. But unfortunately, it's not water soluble. So when I tried to mix it, it wasn't staying in the crystal form, and that was a bit of a failure. That's actually when I discovered the fountain pen invisible ink as a potential solution for this. Mix that instead of water with soap and some white corn syrup, which is a standard bubble mixture for these freezing soap bubbles. And then lit it with the ultraviolet flash, and it looks like it's like some sort of alien egg that's hatching, or I'm not even sure how to describe it, but it's glowing as if it is the light source because you don't see the light source that's coming from the flash. You only see it once it reflects off of the object.
Yeah. This is just totally beautiful. Okay. So the other thing that you're experimenting with at the moment is stereoscopic 3D macro photography. This is almost a it's like a tongue twister to just even say it. But tell us a little bit about this. I mean, first of all, before I forget,
I say anything, I want you to describe the moment that you first saw it in 3D. What were the words that you said? Or paraphrase, or
I don't remember the exact words, but it was like, "Oh my God, and look at the detail." And I was so. Here's the thing. I'll put the next photograph that I'll include in this episode is a ladybird with some aphids down at the bottom there. And what Don had me do, I mean, he's got these antique stereoscopic viewing glasses, and he can print them out on one piece of paper, just as you see in the photograph on the blog. There's two images, and he puts them in this apparatus that basically splits it. It makes your eyes look at both of them as though you were looking at, like, you know, those old, what was the word you mentioned earlier?
Viewmaster.
I used to love my Viewmaster when I was a kid. But Don pointed out that if you go cross-eyed, and for me, I mean, I think my left eye is slightly higher than my right. So I also went cross-eyed, and then I rotated my neck to one side. And as I was doing this, you can actually sort of index, you can draw the two separate images together. And without, you know, if you're at the blog, you'll be able to do this straight away. Just go cross-eyed, and you can see the two images sort of move in together, and then just continue to tilt your head or do whatever you need to do until the two images that you're seeing are perfectly aligned. And the moment you do that, you get this incredible three-dimensional experience. And I was just blown away. So Don, first of all, tell us about how you actually photograph these. What are you doing to photograph them?
So this is using a very special lens designed specifically for this purpose. I should have brought my props here. Even though we're not recording video, it's fun to visualize. It's a tiny lens. Like the barrel of the lens is, half of the size of a regular lens barrel and its overall thickness for a full frame camera. Like you don't imagine that it's going to create a full frame image, but it does. And at the very end, there's two tiny, tiny little lenses that are very, very close together. I think 6.5 millimeters apart. Those will create an image on the camera. It's sort of split all the way down as far as the lens can, so that there's a bit of a blurry line between them that I usually put a sharper divider in place in post-processing. Then that's how the images kind of come to be. Press the shutter button and away you go, except these lenses, because of the extreme magnification, they have to be very small, and thereby their aperture is fixed at f/80. If you look through a viewfinder when your aperture is f/80, you don't really see a whole lot of anything. Yeah. In bright sunlight, when I'm out trying to make a lot of these images, I have to almost let my eye adjust for a minute or so to almost like night vision effect, in order for me to visualize the focus properly. But you also encounter an issue with diffraction, because typically you can tell focus pretty clearly when it snaps in if you're trying to manually focus on something on a lens, because when you're focusing, the maximum aperture is like, I don't know, f2.8 or something, and you can see very, very easily where that perfect point of focus is going to fall. At f80, that's not the case, because diffraction is starting to blur things a little bit, and the most in-focus areas are not quite as sharp as you might otherwise expect, and it doesn't fall off as easily because that aperture is so small. So finding where that focus is going to be requires quite a number of images to be photographed sort of in quick succession. My ring flash that I'm using for this is probably firing at near close to its maximum output in order to get enough light at f80. So I, you know, have to maybe take 5 to 10 pictures in the span of a minute or so. And hopefully in that time frame, I can get one where the focus is where it should be. Focus is the biggest challenge for this, because they're all done handheld. That people have done stereoscopic macro stuff before, but in a studio setting with usually a non-animated subject, like a dead insect or a flower or something that's not going to be moving on you. But most of mine are taken with live creatures. And that becomes a challenge, because now I have to do this in the field where that focus is a nightmare and the light is intense. It's possible, but just barely possible.
Wow. You mentioned, obviously, the focus. When you look at these two images, the one image that's split into two, I can see that it doesn't look as sharp. You can definitely see that there's some diffraction there. But I was amazed. I mean, that's probably why it was such a big shock. But I was amazed that when you actually do go cross-eyed and look at them as one image, the focus is there. It's like, you know, it's as though there was no diffraction. Maybe it's because I'm looking at it on a screen. It's relatively big. I don't know why. I mean, is there a reason for that, do you think?
I encountered the same thing. Yeah. And I was shocked when I saw it too. And now, of course, the diffraction at this macro scale, you're pushing against physics. There's no other way to do it. And so you live with it. And so the first experiments that I had with this lens that I got, you know, it's not a cheap lens, $700 or so.
Wow.
When it came to my door from a company in the Netherlands, of all places, that make these things by hand. DeWidges, I think, is the name of them. And you might still be able to get some from them, although I think that they are an end-of-life product, because there's not a whole lot of demand for this sort of stuff. I'm trying to change that. You know, we're talking about it, getting it some exposure. But when I was looking at the results and I crossed my eyes, I saw the same thing. And I think it has something to do with the fact that the visual input from each eye is going to be slightly different, and it has an additive effect. And so when the two combine together, you see greater detail in that area, because that detail is actually coming from two separate sources and overlapping. And I think that has, there's some mental process that happens to bring that about. That for me saves it. It saves those images from the issue of diffraction.
It definitely does.
And you know, it's funny because, you know, like even when there was an image, I think it was 4622, which has a bee, a honeybee in it. And this one was the very first image that I had taken and I had liked in stereoscopic 3D. And this is not cropped in any way. So in order to get the framing on this at this scale is really a difficult challenge, because the backside of the bee, like the tip of its butt, is missing in one frame, but it's completely there in the other. And one of its antenna, I think, is missing in one frame, but it's there in the other. When you do the 3D effect, you don't notice that, right? Your brain kind of fills in the gaps, and you see the whole thing properly. But in order to get a subject in focus, I'm typically looking at one side. I can't look at both at the same time. You just drive yourself crazy. So through the viewfinder, I'm looking at only typically the right side. And I now have to train myself to, on the right side, give a little bit more space on the right side of it, because the left side is going to be cut off a bit in the final image. Or vice versa. I'm confusing. I have to remind myself how it actually works. Because when you're looking through it, what happens, it's an interesting thing, is the image is recorded onto that. It hits the camera sensor where the right eye is on the right side and the left eye is on the left side, as would be normal. Mm. But then the software and the camera, as you know, what happens through refraction, things flip upside down, right? Yeah, yeah. So the camera actually flips the entire thing inverted. So that means that the left side is on the right side is on the left side, right out of camera, when you're looking at it on the back of the screen, which is how you view it cross-eyed. Because when you cross your eyes, that's how you make the 3D image.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there like a total goof looking at the back of my camera screen cross-eyed. And it works. So, and again, getting that framing right is always going to be a challenge. And but if you were to look at this with the frames in the wrong order, say if I took the reversed pair and looked at it through a stereoscope viewer, the bee's backside appears to be in front of its back leg, not behind it. And so it looks just weird and broken if you see them in the wrong pattern.
Wow.
So there's a lot of psychology going on when you start to explore this this area of photography. And I should say, 3D photography has been around for well over a century.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got stereo viewers, and these things were designed in the 1850s, I believe. this one is from the turn of the century. That this 1904, I think, that I've got here. I've got one from 1901, and they're really elegant things. They're well built. The lenses in them are better than I would have expected for that vintage. Mm. And they're like $30 or $40 on eBay.
Wow.
I mean, they're ridiculously cheap too, to start experimenting and exploring this particular area. But Martin and I always push things further.
You do. You know, before we push things over the edge and wrap up, I wanted to look at that. You know, there's one more here that I'd love to just take a look at the ant photograph as well. So 4973.
We'll do that, but I also want to do 5505 after that as a final wrap.
Okay.
But the ant image was a really interesting one because it kind of goes in series with the ladybird image, because ladybirds hunt aphids, but ants protect them.
Oh, wow.
Because ants like to drink aphid pee. this is a really interesting phenomenon, really, because the aphids will be sucking a lot of the fluids out of plants. That's their MO, in order to get valuable nutrients like nitrogen and other things like that. Mm. But those quantities are in shorter supply compared to the water and the sugars and that sort of stuff. Mm. So the aphids must extract a fair amount of this and just kind of have that as a byproduct. Mm. Aphid pee, as it were. it has a name. It's called honeydew, which sounds a lot more pleasing.
Yeah, yeah.
But the ants love this stuff, just like ants like sugar water, which gave me the idea for that other weird experiment. But so the ants will tend an aphid colony like they're farming them.
Wow.
And they'll tickle them with their antennas, and the aphids know to respond by releasing their honeydew at that time. And so you watch these ants crawling all over these aphid colonies, protecting them. You know, the aphids give them something to eat, and the ants offer protection. It's a really nice sort of symbiotic relationship there.
I didn't know that. I know that ants, they farm fungi, don't they?
I think they might do that too.
They grow a certain type of fungi to get something from it. I've seen a documentary about it. They're a farming insect. It's amazing, the intelligence of these creatures.
It is. And so when I see this, I want to try and tell that as a story, right? Mm, and it's a difficult story to tell because aphids are not a really pretty creature. Ants aren't either. And they're usually growing on plants that are struggling because all the aphids are sucking out all the good stuff. So there's a lot stacked up against you. But when you see it in 3D and the ant is kind of hovering on top of the aphids that are a little bit out of focus in the background. But it kind of brings those elements together. And this also introduces another element of 3D photography, where it's not just the 2D composition you have to be concerned with. Mm. The 3D composition is also important.
Yeah.
And so you need to have 3D depth within the range that you're capturing in order to guide your eye from one part of the frame to another.
Yeah.
And that's something that no photographer would ever have to worry about when you're shooting conventionally. Mm. And some images that I thought would be really awesome in 3D, like I did a water droplet refraction shot on on a wildflower seed, and I got these big droplets, and then I got a flower in the background, but there was only two levels of depth, something in the front, something in the back. And it just didn't follow my eye through it, and it failed as a 3D image. Wow. Where the ants and the aphids, I think, work quite well because the leaves kind of curl and they add some depth in behind.
Yeah. So the last one that you were talking about, 5505?
Yeah. That's another stereoscopic pair. That was inspired by the earlier one that we had looked at that was like the universe inside of a droplet. Because that was a first experiment. But I figured, well, I can take this a step farther. Because I've got vials of highlighter ink. And this one's a green one here, but I've got orange and red. And again, these are designed for like fountain pens or like refillable highlighter stuff. And they're easy to get a hold of for a couple of bucks. But they fluoresce typically in different colors. So the orange one fluoresces orange. And so what if I take that little needle and fill it up with orange highlighter fluid and put a droplet of that in the center or just off the center of a flower where all of the pollen is starting to emerge. And build that up enough so that it looks like there's this little spot of lava in the center of a flower. And then it creates this whole overarching kind of glow effect on all of the nearby particles of pollen and the stamens and the little tiny petals that are interspliced within that daisy-like flower right along the edge. It looks like a campfire or a pit of lava inside of a flower. And this was done in 3D. You know, it would be a challenging enough image to produce just as a single standard ordinary photograph. But I figured, well, why not try and see if it can be done in 3D? And just barely it can. Wow. That was done with, again, those two ultraviolet flashes at full tilt to give enough light to come in here at some, you know, ISO 6400. It's a challenge to do it. But it ends up being something that, okay, well, now what happens if I mix the invisible ink, which is blue, the highlighter ink, which is in green and orange? Can I like put these different droplets around and like create this structure, this sculpture of these droplets that glow differently when I this is where I'm going. I haven't gone there yet, but God help me when I get there.
Well, where can people see this stuff? You know, they obviously, I'm myself included, we're going to want to follow your progress as you dive deeper into this realm. Where can people go to see this?
Every new experiment gets posted on social media, on Facebook and Google Plus and Flickr and all of that. And those are all linked to on my website at doncom.ca. Okay. So if you check that out, donkom.ca. The newest stuff that I've been working on might not be there yet on that website because I only update it a few times a year. But if you check the social media streams, you'll find a lot of the fun stuff just sitting about as they come in. You know, typically the day I shoot something new, I get really excited about it and post it the same day. and so you see kind of like a stream of consciousness as I go through all of these different ideas.
Yeah. And that's great. I mean, that's one of the things that makes you such an attractive person to follow online. You've got the, Like we said from the start, and you've proved throughout this conversation, your inquisitive nature and your ability to figure out. I mean, I honestly could probably go online and look up a few of these things, but I just wouldn't know where to start with half of this stuff. So, you know, hats off, applauds for the work that you do. I think it's amazing, and it's been a total pleasure talking with you about this today, Don.
Thank you, Martin. I think that the final concept here that everybody should take home is that you need to experiment and you need to make mistakes and you need to revel in those mistakes. You need to take those mistakes as a learning process that is more valuable than a successful image because it will help you more in the long run than that successful image will help you in the short run. And so for each mistake that I make, I intentionally learn something from it. Like I force myself to. And that process over time, repeated 1,000 times and more, will eventually find you doing things that no other photographer has done. So keep at it, embrace those mistakes because they will lead to all sorts of these wonderful little areas of photography that are fascinating, interesting to you. And when you share them with the world, it opens up people's minds to new possibilities. And the world is better for that, I think.
Absolutely. And you mentioned earlier as well, I think, that you are preparing to launch a podcast under the TWIP umbrella. So that's going to be all about this kind of stuff as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's called Inside the Lens, and it's the total geekery of photography. anything from color science to electron microscopy to the finer points of printing and extra spectrum photography, et cetera, et cetera. It's the science photography podcast. Mm. And I'm sure there'll be some psychological play in there, too. And we've already recorded, I think, up to 6 or 7 episodes now. And we are launching very, very soon.
Yeah.
So look for that on the TWIP network in the very near future.
I wish you the best of luck with that. I'll be tuning in as well. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and wish you the best of luck with your photography and the new podcast as well.
Thank you, Martin.
Okay, so Don and I had actually finished talking there. We were going to wrap it up, but he brought up, as we continued talking, he brought up another photograph that we felt we just had to include. So I'm going to include the rest of the conversation here.
I know that you've probably got a busy day, but there is one more thing that has to happen here. Mm. I have to send you one more stereoscopic image. There we go. To Martin. You've got an image incoming in stereoscopic 3D that, again, I think is one of the most difficult things to do, because the light, the equipment, and the technology just do not cooperate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, got it. So this is the mosquito again.
This is the mosquito in 3D.
Let me just, okay, align my eyes. It's not working properly at the moment. Oh, look at that. That is just insane.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah.
So in order to do this, I had to have those flashes that I have, the two flashes at point blank range at 100% power. Mm. I had to completely cover up the camera from any ambient light source, put it on bulb mode, fire the flashes manually from my remote trigger, let them completely recharge, do it again and again and again and again and again and again, like 8 times, two flashes, full power on that guy in order to get it at about half that illumination. It was boosted up in post in order to make that happen in 3D. So that I know has never been done before.
Wow.
Not even been attempted. And so.
Oh, that's brilliant. I'm going to try and splice this in.
Yeah. And that image was done at like some absurd ISO as well. It's like, okay, well, I mean, I'm going to have to push it to whatever crazy limits that the camera would let me. And thankfully with the 1DX Mark II that I currently have, it does survive very well at higher ISOs. This was 3200. I did one at 6400 as well, but this one worked out better. And when you cross your eyes, the interesting thing is higher noise images, when you do that, they get a sparkle effect because the noise overlaps and thereby it doesn't work properly, and the object kind of sparkles a bit. It's kind of a neat thing.
It adds to the effect for sure.
Yeah.
Wow.
So there you go.
Yeah. Well, once again, thanks, Don. I'll include this in the podcast as well, because that's just amazing. And that also takes us away from, we had 13 images at the end there, and that's unlucky. So now we've got 14.
Perfect.
But brilliant. Thanks. Once again, thanks so much for your time today, Don, and for
welcome.
An excellent conversation.
And in the next couple of weeks, I will be shooting the Perseid meteor shower in stereoscopic 3D.
Ooh.
With a different treatment.
So. I look forward to seeing that as well.
Yeah, who knows? All right, Martin. Have yourself a great day, and
you
we'll
too.
Chat again soon.
All right, thanks a lot then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so that's the end proper this time. I hope you enjoyed that. I really did. I love talking with Don. And do go to the blog, like I say. Open up the browser really wide and just try to cross your eyes and align these photographs, the 3D ones. Because once you get that effect, it really is crazy. He's doing some incredible work there. So thanks very much for listening today. If you enjoy this podcast, please share a link with your friends. And if you don't already, please subscribe in iTunes or your favorite podcast program to ensure uninterrupted delivery. If you have a moment to rate the podcast or leave us a review in iTunes as well, that helps to keep us relevant in the huge number of podcasts out there now. You can find me on Google+, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and links to everything that I'm up to are at martinbaileyphotography.com. so do drop by and take a look. I'll be back next week with another episode, but in the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.